This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, we'll look at the latest Egyptian election follies with the disqualification of 10 candidates, among them a Mubarak loyalist and a leading contender from the Muslim Brotherhood. We'll be speaking with Lisa Hajar on the latest twists and turns in the transition that may or may not come inside Egypt. Also, we'll be joined by Dr. Francis Boyle on State Department intervention in a celebration of Nobel Peace Prize winners. There's a boycott underway. That and more coming up in today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And since our last coverage of Egypt, there have been numerous developments over the weekend, including the disqualification by the Election Council of nearly a dozen candidates, including some leading contenders from the old Mubarak regime and from the new Muslim Brotherhood. And we are now today rejoined by Egyptian expert and scholar at the University of California at Santa Barbara, Lisa Hajar. Welcome back, Lisa.
Thank you.
The real election fight seems to be not among the voters, but among the regulators. What do you make of these disqualifications?
The Supreme Council for the Armed Forces, which is the current ruling group in Egypt, moved quickly, to put forward these elections. And in doing so, for a number of reasons, part of which we see now is that, on the one hand, to assuage or, tamp down the revolution, and for another, just to sort of move the country into a post, military junta-controlled state. But they've instituted laws that, in fact, have made it extremely difficult and complicated for people to run for the election. Now, whether that's bad or not, considering some of the candidates, is one thing, but it is this sort of power that the SCAF holds to more or less determine who's going to actually make it to the field on rather arbitrary types of issues. So, for example, the disqualification of the candidate from the Muslim Brothers, who was really probably poised to win the election if the legislative elections were any indication, where the Muslim Brothers, came in with the most votes. He's been disqualified, ironically, because he'd been prosecuted and convicted for being a Muslim Brother during the Mubarak regime. So that rule is one that, seems very dedicated to maintaining a particular kind of vision about what the state will be from the pre to the post-Mubarak era.
And in February and March, actually, was there not a ruling from the Egyptian courts that the record would be expunged and he thereby be eligible to run?
Well, that's what I think people had assumed. And when he came forward as one of the candidates, this is El-Shatzer, when he came forward as one of the candidates, I think, the understanding was that he was qualified to run. And so this very late in the game disqualification indicates probably some political maneuvering disregarding the decision of the court. Another person who's been disqualified is the leading Salafi candidate, and the Salafis also did extremely well in the legislative elections, and he's been disqualified on the grounds that his mother became an American citizen, toward the end of her life. So for that reason, they're alleging that he's not really an Egyptian because of his mother's change in citizenship.
So that's an Egyptian version of President Obama's birth certificate citizenship problem of the Tea Party in the United States.
Exactly. The dubious legitimacy of holding citizenship or any attachment to another country seems to be not strictly a monopoly of the United States.
Lisa, can you give a little bit of background for people who are becoming more and more aware of the nuances of Egyptian politics? What is the Salafist movement?
Well, the Salafis are basically people who subscribe to a very conservative interpretation of Islam, and particularly the kind that Saudi Arabia harbors and endorses. It's called like sort of a Wahhabi, a bit of like, you know, Islamic Puritans, or and what people who are very intent on a kind of fundamentalist interpretation of, you know, how Islamic law should be interpreted and enforced. The reason the Salafi movement has grown in Egypt over the last decades and really has come out of, you know, the shadows since the revolution is that, you know, many hundreds of thousands of Egyptians have gone to Saudi Arabia over the decades to obtain work, you know, partly because of, you know, the limited economic opportunities in Egypt. And so in Saudi Arabia, a lot of people have been influenced by that kind of Wahhabi ideology, which is completely dominant to the point of being hegemonic in Saudi Arabia. So they've come back and sort of brought, you know, to Egypt when they returned to Egypt, bringing that ideology with them. And the Saudi government certainly, you know, as it does in other countries, has been pumping money to support candidates and parties, and particularly the Salafi Anwar movement, that are, you know, mouthpieces of the kind of ideological view of Islam that Saudi Arabia favors.
Well, now we have the at least temporary disqualification of Omar Suleiman, the legacy of the Mubarak regime, CIA collaborator, intelligence director, and Khayrat al-Shater of the Muslim Brotherhood. Yet I understand that they have since we last spoke, and since the ruling of the Election Commission, have rapidly moved to nominate a substitute Muslim Brotherhood candidate. So are those leaders interchangeable in terms of policy?
Well, you know, I think that there was a bit of a scramble among the Muslim Brothers, you know, several months ago about who actually would run. And in fact, there were several people who wanted to run and were sort of muscled out by al-Shater, you know, perhaps, and by the older, you know, senior leadership of the Muslim Brothers on the grounds that they assumed that he had a great deal of legitimacy. I mean, partly because he has spent so much time in Egyptian prisons, and also because of the fact that he's a highly successful businessman, and paradoxically that he was able to be a highly successful businessman from prison. So I think he had, you know, certain attributes that the Muslim Brothers thought would be very appealing to their constituents. But there were other people who were kind of muscled out, and perhaps if the exclusion of al-Shater sticks, then one of the other or more of the other people may, you know, throw their hat into the ring if there's still time. I don't know exactly what, whether it's still possible for people who want to run to gather signatures to do so, because that, I mean, that's one of the reasons why Omar Suleiman was, you know, or has been at least ostensibly disqualified, because he was 30 signatures shy of the 30,000 that he needed.
Lisa Hajar, one of the things we've not addressed yet is the elephant and the donkey standing in the room of the Egyptian elections, and by that I mean the International Republican Institute and the National Endowment for Democracy and the United States government-backed agencies, including the State Department, that assisted in the so-called Internet revolution of last spring in Egypt. And for many Americans, that's the point of reference or entry into whatever transitions are or are not taking place inside Egypt. And during that time, one of the great favorites of the April 6th youth movement and others of the internet persuasion was Mohamed El-Baradei, the former head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, who at one point was thought to be a contender for the presidency. But the parliamentary elections seem to indicate that that cup is not holding much water. What happened to the so-called Arab Spring candidacies?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I think a lot of people were very disappointed. I mean, especially those who are, you know, the secularists, younger folks and people really dedicated to the kind of transformative goals that the revolution represented. Abarde, ultimately decided that he couldn't run because he simply couldn't manage the obstacle course that was, thrown up in order, for people to pass through in order to, be qualified for the election. So he decided to, not throw his hat into the ring. I think he had, in statements he made, he simply said it was just too complicated and he was too unable to, pull it together on time.
Well, at the same time, he is currently twittering his thumbs away. And among the messages that he is asserting today is that there is a cart before the horse problem in Egypt. That is to say, there is a rush after this American and international internet-catalyzed insurrection in Tahrir Square that did lead to some changes, that now the Electoral Council and the army command structure is attempting to rush into a presidential election before the actual powers and prerogatives and responsibilities of the presidency are determined, and indeed to claim domain over the decisions that are made in the parliamentary definition of a new constitution. Does he have a point there?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, one can see the speed at which, the SCAF, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, has moved to, put on elections is part of, is a strategy in the goal of not, allowing too much change to occur. I mean, it was a speed that actually prevented a real, grounding of some of the demands of the revolution and, equally importantly, allowing enough time for new parties to form that could, effectively compete either in the legislative election or and even more so in the presidential election. So the speed itself is in part can be sold to, both a domestic and an international audience as a sign of the Supreme Council's, unwillingness to continue ruling the country indefinitely. But it is also paradoxically that speed, which will ensure that there won't be the kind of changes that the revolutionaries had hoped to see instituted, at least not now. So the revolution continues.
There has been, perhaps as it has sometimes seemed to me, a very subtle pas de deux, a dance between the Mubarak military-based United States-supported structure of government and the frequently imprisoned members of the Muslim Brotherhood, that despite these Casablanca-type movie raids and arrests, that there was some kind of mutual balance of power between the two. Can you tell us how powerful Muslim Brotherhood is and to what extent they are able to play along with the military regime and to what extent they would in any way fundamentally disagree or diverge from their positions?
That's an excellent question. I think that the history, the Muslim Brothers certainly in the last half a year have, if not directly allied themselves with the Supreme Council, have certainly seen a kind of mutual interest. I mean, not least of which is that the Muslim Brothers are a huge party. They command a great deal of support and respect, for several reasons, that they are regarded as something truly different from the old, from the Mubarak regime. They're regarded as, sort of the keepers of, Egyptian religious and cultural traditions and so on. But part of this story, in some ways goes back to the history of the Muslim Brothers and the shifting ideology. In the, late 1970s and early 1980s, the Muslim Brothers were, engaged, or some of them were engaged in much more radical politics to, really seek to overthrow the regime and institute an Islamic State. There is, still, certainly many people would harbor the idea of a much more Islamic State than Egypt already is now, but they more or less relinquished that position, largely as a result of incredible, you know, repression and imprisonment of thousands of Muslim brothers, you know, over the years of the Mubarak regime, and have adopted a much more pragmatic approach. And this is something one sees in Muslim focused parties across the Middle East, that some have basically decided they are going to be political players and seek to, you know, exercise their power through the electoral process. That's something that the Muslim Brothers have done. It's a kind of pragmatism that deviates from their earlier ideology, you know, going back to the 30s and 40s, an earlier ideological position, which was that devout Muslims should not be part of the state, you know, should not be, you know, joining in the state. But at this point, I think the goals, you know, for example, to ramp up that the, you know, the power of Sharia law, particularly in the area of family law in Egypt, to have a more domineering role, you know, over education and public policy and so on, are reasons why Muslim Brothers, particularly the older leadership, see great advantages in getting into the political game now that it really, a lot of things are up in the air, and they are a powerful and large party that does, as they showed in the legislative elections, has the capacity to actually really make an extremely strong showing.
So Egypt is in some ways like the United States, with a strong base two-party system between the Muslim Brotherhood and the Mubarak remnants. Well, I thank you so much for coming on with these breaking developments in regard to Egypt and the electoral process. Lisa Hajar, a professor of sociology at the University of California at Santa Barbara. And Lisa has been very busy lately with her recent piece called Omar Suleiman, the CIA's Man in Cairo and Egypt's Torturer-in-Chief. She has been cited and quoted recently also in USA Today in the article, Suleiman's Reputation Holds Dread for Some in Egypt. What else have you been up to, and how can people follow you, Lisa?
I've been, you know, looking at Egypt and particularly Suleiman, you know, derives from my interest in torture. So I do a lot of writing and speaking on torture-related issues, particularly those concerning the U.S. So that's why my interest in Suleiman's connection to the CIA and the Extraordinary Rendition Program. Where I publish a lot is on the website Jadalia, which people can find at, you know, www.jadmag, short for Jadalia Magazine, .com, as well as Middle East Research and Information Project.
Well, thank you for another information-filled encounter in these fast-moving developments in regard to Egypt. Lisa Hajar of the University of California at Santa Barbara.
Thank you, Robert.
See you soon. This is 5 o'clock Shadow, Robert Knight here in New York. And the position of the Muslim Brotherhood is one that is adaptive. In fact, over the past 5 years, there have been inklings that the leadership, or some elements of the Muslim Brotherhood leadership, have been willing to engage in a more constructive relationship with the United States government. That was a matter of some urgency in a State Department cable that was sent from the embassy in Cairo that paid great attention to a Muslim Brotherhood initiative for better relationships with the United States government. This is from WikiLeaks State Department official cable, February 2007.
Muslim Brotherhood parliamentary bloc leader calls for dialogue with USG. Origin: Embassy, Cairo, Egypt, January 24, 2007. Confidential. Summary: The parliamentary leader of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood made a recent public statement indicating a desire to initiate a constructive dialogue with Western governments, including the USG. Meanwhile, opposition press and Cairo think tanks are rife with rumors that some recently arrested senior Muslim Brotherhood members were advocating for direct dialogue with the USG directly prior to their arrests. End summary. On December 15, a lengthy statement by Dr. Saad al-Khatatni, head of the Muslim Brotherhood's parliamentary bloc, called for dialogue between the Muslim Brotherhood and Western governments. Some of his key points. Text of Saad al-Khatatni's statement. Dialogue between Islamists and the West a necessity. Over the past several years, the relationship between the West and Islamic movements has become of vital importance, for several reasons. First, The Islamic movements have been on the rise in several Muslim countries for the past decade, but more so for the past few years. Both radical and moderate Islamic movements have been gaining more momentum, and have proved in their own way, to be key players in the political arena in Arab and Muslim worlds. Despite the ongoing crackdowns by regimes, moderate Islamic movements have successfully continued their peaceful struggle, and gained more popular support. Radical movements, on the other hand, have sharpened their capabilities and carried out more deadly terrorist attacks in several countries. The rise of Islamic movements could have been of minimal significance to Western societies, just as was the rise of the conservative right-wing groups in the United States, for example, to the people of the Middle East a century ago. However, in the age of globalization where different corners of the world are interconnected, and in some cases interdependent, building mutual understanding is of the utmost importance to the interest of all parties and to global peace. Current relations between the Islamists and the West are not in their best possible shape. Several obstacles hinder the development of strong, healthy relations between both sides. The West's support of oppressive regimes in the Middle East is one of the major reasons behind Islamists' growing skepticism of the West's genuine belief in democracy. The provoking example is the Hamas-led government, which has been democratically elected by the Palestinian people only to find itself under siege by the international community led by the United States and Europe. This act clearly illustrates a huge gap between the West's political discourse and its political action in reality, a gap that undermines the trust between Islamists and the West. Western governments have been supporting authoritarian regimes in the region despite their flagrant violations of basic human rights and their lack of commitment to political and social reform. Moreover, the West continues to support the Egyptian regime despite the crimes it is committing against its political opponents, especially during the recent parliamentary elections in November 2005 where 11 voters were killed by police and tens of others injured in order to prevent them from casting their votes. In addition, the imprisonment of political opposition leaders like Ayman Nour, Talat al-Sadat, and hundreds of Islamists including prominent, moderate and well-known figures such as Dr. Issam El-Aryan and Dr. Mohamed Morsi. The West also supported the regime in its standoff against judges, journalists, lawyers, workers, students, and other active elements of the civil society. At most, the Western governments publicly condemned the regime's harsh crackdowns, but never really pressured it for any real change on the ground. In the post-9/11 world, the rise of the conservative right in Western countries, such as the United States and some Scandinavian countries, and its influence over policymakers and the electoral process in general, added fuel to the tension between Islamists and Western governments. The conservative movements not only mistakenly branded all Islamists with terrorism, but also accused the moderate ones of working secretively to conquer the West and re-establish the caliphate, and consequently rejected any dialogue with them. Therefore, a growing state of Islamophobia has been on the rise in the West, which created an unhealthy atmosphere for many Muslim minorities living in these very societies who have been subject to discrimination and racial profiling. Another reason behind the unhealthy relations between Islamists and the West is the refusal by many intellectuals and policy makers in the West to recognize the clear ideological difference between moderate and radical Islamists, insisting on lumping all of them together in one basket. In a recent poll conducted by Zogby International, 50% of Americans surveyed did not see any difference between the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda, which is a clear indication of the misinformation prevailing in Western societies about our movement. Finally, yet more importantly, one should not underestimate the effect of regimes in the Middle East in destroying the relations between the West and Islamists. As part of their survival strategies in power, these regimes try to monopolize their relations with the West, portraying their political opponents as undemocratic and anti-Western who pose a threat to their interests, and therefore the regimes appear to the West as their best alternative. Having said that, one has to ask the most crucial question. Could there be a constructive dialogue between Islamists, the United States and the European Union? If yes, then how such a dialogue can take place? The answer to the first half of the question has to be yes. There is really no other alternative for the West or Islamists but to engage in a constructive dialogue to reach a common ground based on the mutual understanding and the appreciation of diversity. For such dialogue to be fruitful, openness and sincerity on both sides are a necessity. Islamists need to revisit their views on the West. They have to come to realize that different views can be present in one single Western society. Islamists have to realize that the West is not fundamentally anti-Islamic, and that some pro-democratic movements in the West are in fact willing to engage in dialogue and maintain relations with moderate Islamists, and accept the fact that Islamists and Islamic movements in general are the reflection of the people's true will. Islamists also need to overcome the obstacles put forward by the regimes and to reach out to the West explaining their views regarding issues that are of concern to Westerners. Islamists also need to present a clear and unambiguous vision about how the Western presence in the region on the economic, political, cultural and military levels will change if the Islamists were to come to power. So far, Islamists' views on these issues have been distorted, either by the media or by Islamists themselves in their inability to communicate their agenda in a Western-friendly format, and even sometimes by the regimes, or special interest groups opposing the rise of Islamists. Western governments, especially those of the EU and the United States, must present a clear vision regarding the democratization process in the Middle East and their willingness to respect the choice of the people in free elections regardless of the outcome. Such a clear vision has to be reflected in policies, not just hollow promises and slogans. The West also needs to come to a realization that there will always be differences between the Islamists and the Westerners. However, Islamists will not impose their beliefs or way of life on Westerners, just as Westerners should refrain from doing the same on Islamists. We both need to be culturally sensitive to each other's preferences and respect our differences in realizing that diversity will continue to exist, and is a part of the human experience. We should work together in a civilized manner to reach a common ground on our differences without resorting to arrogant force or hateful violence. Consequently, Western governments need to answer a decisive question: what do they really expect from Islamists? In what formula will the West accept Islamists as partners? The West needs to identify a clear set of conditions upon which it is willing to deal with the Islamists instead of giving them an endless list of demands. Western intellectuals, politicians, and policymakers need to realize the consequences of their policies in the Middle East, both in the long and short term. Propping up oppressive regimes will undermine the opportunity for peaceful change and reform and will reinforce the sentiment of radical Islamists, whose cause will become more popular as the support enjoyed by the moderates is not translated into political gain. Inevitably, the spread of radicalism will be manifested in terrorist attacks, both inside and outside the Middle East. New generations of frustrated and repressed individuals in the Middle East will resort to terrorism, which will be impossible to defeat in the so-called War on Terror. This neo-terrorism has already begun to take shape with the recent attacks that took place in Daib, Sharm el-Sheikh, Amman, just to name a few. The concern is that if tensions continue to mount due to oppression practiced by authoritarian regimes and sanctioned by their Western allies, terrorist attacks will be on the rise and will be a plague across the world. The West needs also to realize that, sooner or later, the will of the people will be victorious.
And that, from a United States State Department cable from the U.S. Embassy in Cairo, in regard to an overture from the so-called Muslim Brotherhood for a closer dialogue and coordination with the United States government. And one of the people referenced in that policy statement, Mohamed Morsi, was this weekend brought to renewed prominence as a possible substitute presidential contender for the Muslim Brotherhood in the electoral slate that is being challenged and whittled down by the Electoral Commission there. That appeal process has 2 more days to go and 10 more days until the final list is presumably to be announced. So we'll stay on that story. This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacific Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And now we turn to another area other than the Tahrir Square demonstrations and the April 6th movement, in which the United States State Department has been quietly involved. There is a planned summit conference of winners of the Nobel Prize coming up in Chicago, but already that is being boycotted because of statements by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton that she and her agency were very much involved in this Nobel Peace Prize summit. We're fortunate to be joined by Professor Francis Boyle of the University of Illinois College of Law and also the author of Tackling America's Toughest Questions. Well, my question, Professor Boyle, is what is happening with the Nobel laureates?
Well, Robert, thank you for having me on. This has always been a problem with the so-called Nobel Peace Prize, going back to when they gave one of them to Kissinger for the outright genocide he inflicted in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. I've been following it since then because at that time I was going through the same PhD program at Harvard that produced Kissinger, and they even gave me Kissinger's old office at the Center for International Affairs. The Nobel Peace Prize is awarded basically by Norwegian politicians, and Norway is a member of the NATO alliance. So it comes as no surprise then that these so-called peace prizes really promote the NATO agenda. And so now, as I put it, the Nobel Peace Prizers have come out of the NATO closet. It's clear if you watch the Clinton video that the U.S. State Department has been quietly working behind the scenes for quite some time to set up the so-called Summit of Nobel Peace Prize Winners in Chicago as part of the run-up to the NATO War Fest that will be held in Chicago now in less than a month. And indeed, Secretary of State Clinton said that this Department of State is quite proud of the fact that it will be, quote, an active partner with the Nobel Peace Prize winners in Chicago. So I think it's very clear now what the agenda is here when it comes to the Nobel Peace Prize. Remember, they gave one to Obama when it was very clear he was escalating the war in Afghanistan and escalating the attacks on Pakistan.
And would proceed to overthrow one of the most developed nations in Africa, certainly in the north, the nation of Libya. With
That's
NATO.
Correct, although he did that after he got the Nobel Peace Prize. But I guess the point I'm making is that when they gave him the Nobel Peace Prize, he was already engaging in the escalation of the war in Afghanistan and escalating the drone wars against Pakistan, which certainly should have disqualified him. But, you know, these NATO politicians wanted to give their seal of approval to Obama. So this is typical with the Nobel Peace Prize, at least, you know, since I've been following it when they gave it to Kissinger. And I want to say I've been a qualified nominator for the Nobel Peace Prize in accordance with the will of Alfred Nobel ever since I began teaching international law at Harvard in 1976, and you know, for years I refused to make a nomination. I only did recently make an exception for Governor George Ryan out here to encourage him to clear out death row. But other than that, I really stayed away from the Nobel Peace Prize because it was so transparent, artificial cover for NATO warmongering. And now they're all going out to Chicago. I did bring this to the attention of Mrs. McGuire, the Nobel Peace Prize winner from Ireland. I'm Irish-American, and we were both mutual friends of the late, great Sean McBride, former Nobel Peace Prize winner and IRA chief of staff. And when she took a look at at Clinton's statement, she was shocked. She was unaware of this. And so she thought about it and decided to boycott, drafted a letter that you can see on our press release. She drafted it and circulated it to all her fellow Nobel Peace Prize winners. So on Sunday, I received a snotty little message from Jody Williams, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, saying that she was going to go to Chicago anyway, and she was not going to be intimidated by people like me bullying from the left.
Wait a minute. Just a moment. Why would you be bullying a Peace Prize winner?
Well, that's exactly the point, isn't it? And then I responded by saying to Williams, I said, look here, I am not, quote, an active partner with, close quote, the United States Department of State and the U.S. Secretary of State, and I am not an active partner with the clerk, the apartheid president of South Africa, who was so abhorrent that he even refused to appear before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Professor Boyle, the I guess the intrusion or participation of the State Department in what most citizens might think of as high-minded peace-seeking affair, as we know is not the case from the winning of the prize by Henry Kissinger, Barack Obama, and a number of others. The State Department seems to have its hand in many pies. The claim and the interface for participation in this so-called Nobel Summit in Chicago is one thing, but another thing that we studied here is the State Department's involvement in the so-called internet revolutions and the color-coded revolutions around the world. We spent some time analyzing the State Department sponsorship, along with Freedom House, of an Alliance for Youth Movement summit that involved many of the key people in what would later become the so-called Arab Spring in Egypt and elsewhere around the world. So I'm curious about the degree to which State Department, intelligence, or otherwise United States interested funders may subvert or pimp what might otherwise be legitimate movements. Have you spent much time thinking about the way...
Everything you said is correct about the color revolutions. All that can be documented from the public record. Indeed, this Anne-Marie Slaughtered, who was behind me at Harvard Law School, orchestrated the whole Green Revolution in Iran, and then as she walked out the door, had set in play the war against Libya. Freedom House is a well-known front organization for the Central Intelligence Agency. So with the Republican National Institute, and the same with the Democrats, these people are, you know, are very smart, very clever, very sophisticated. They know exactly what they were doing. They are very media savvy, and they use human rights and democracy as a pretext to justify war, terrorism, and subversion, as we saw in Libya, as we're seeing now in Syria, as they're threatening towards Iran. Sure, we cannot underestimate these people. I, as I said, I went through the same PhD program at Harvard that produced Kissinger deliberately just to find out how these people operate. And I, fortunately then, because of this training, was able to pick up on the State Department working behind the scenes to set up this Nobel Peace Prize confab in Chicago as part of the run-up to the NATO Warfest in Chicago. Sure.
Well, there are quite a number of legitimate populist movements around the world that do seek a better form of equity than elections, than the dominance of United States foreign funding for military stability, and so on. And tragically, there has also been that process striking close to home here in New York with the Occupy Wall Street movement, where in November, a consultant with State Department-related agencies put forward a proposal at the General Assembly to spend $29,000 to send a dozen or two people to Egypt to, quote, observe the elections, end quote. And this is a typical part of the State Department international policy that is consonant with the color-coded revolutions. Now, as far as I understand, that trip has not happened.
The CIA has infiltrated the New York Police Department, sure.
What are they doing there?
Well, they had a CIA agent right there in the New York Police Department setting up this program to monitor Arabs and Muslims and infiltrate their mosques and their communities and send in agents provocateurs and try to entrap them into committing criminal activity.
Well, at Oakland, California, in the recent police push there, there were on the rooftops of buildings as the park was evacuated by military police tactics, there were representatives from the Department of Homeland Security. And Dr. Francis Boyle of the University of Illinois College of Law, here's, I guess, the attempted redemptive thing about these questions and the ever-present danger of infiltration and subversion. How do legitimate, heartfelt populist movements protect themselves or identify the infiltration and subversion that is attempted to be done every day by police and state and government and federal and security and homeland security forces?
Well, I think the first principle to understand is that any new person who shows up and encourages you to commit an act of violence or something that is clearly illegal, the odds are quite high they are a government informer, an agent provocateur. So that's pretty good one test right there. And by the way, back in the summer of 2006, agents for the FBI and the CIA-FBI Joint Terrorist Task Force appeared here at my office, tried to get me to become an informant on my Arab and Muslim clients, which I refused to do, and then put me on all the United States government's terrorist watch lists, where I currently am. My lawyer estimates there's five or six of them, and I'm on all of them. He has enable me at least now to fly, but I really don't know exactly what does happen to me, or will happen to me whenever I do fly, especially out of the country. But on that list I was on, there was about 5,000 Arabs, Muslims, and supporters. And my guess is the standard operating procedure there was to turn them all into informants for the FBI and the CIA. So I just ask you, out of the 5,000 on that list, how many do you think said no, like I did, being a lawyer and a law professor? I think that is the type of situation we're up against. In addition, as you know, here in the United States, so many of these peace and justice movements are either de facto arms of the Democratic Party or run by stalwarts or operatives for the Democratic Party. For example, I was on the Uniting for Peace and Justice list and computer list and was participating and whatever with my expertise as a law professor. And when Obama started bombing Libya, I said that he should be impeached for this clearly illegal and unconstitutional war. Whereupon they threw me off of the Uniting for Peace and Justice list. So I think you have a pretty good idea, you know, that the Democratic Party is behind Uniting for Peace and Justice or Move On or so many of these other NGO-type organizations, which is why Occupy Wall Street and, you know, its equivalents around the country are such a threat to the financial power elite who run this country. And that is why this early winter, they passed the National Defense Authorization Act, giving the military authority to pick up anyone they want to here in the United States take them into custody and disappear them. And we know from Senator Levin that President Obama himself demanded that the NDAA apply to United States citizens. It had originally been drafted not to apply to U.S. citizens, and according to Levin, Obama demanded it apply to United States citizens. Now, the alleged pretext was Al-Qaeda, but even U.S. intelligence agencies admit there might be 50 Al-Qaeda guys running around there in the mountains somewhere between Afghanistan and Pakistan. So the NDAA is really, I believe, the motive force, and the primary target of the NDAA is the Occupy Wall Street movement all over the country. And that's really why that draconian piece of legislation was enacted into law to get U.S. citizens. It's not they're concerned about Al-Qaeda. They're concerned about our own people. They're concerned about, you know, Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Chicago, Occupy San Francisco, Occupy L.A., et cetera.
Professor Francis Boyle of the University of Illinois Law, and your horror story about the exclusion on the travel list, it's a constitutional shock to the conscience. Not only the something as explicit as that, but who knows what surreptitious measurement is being made by government subpoenas of, or was in many cases not even to the level of subpoena, of Google records, of search records, of emails. This is a shock to the constitutional conscience of the First Amendment, which implies freedom of association, if I'm not mistaken, and association involves the right to travel. So is the Constitution lost at this point?
I think what we're going to see up in Chicago in the NATO War Fest is de facto, if not outright de jure, martial law. I was there in 1968, and you effectively had de facto martial law. So I think we're going to see pretty close to de jure martial law in operation up there in Chicago this summer. I'm afraid to say that, and there could be a lot of violence instigated by the United States government, DHS, Army snipers. Everything has been prepared up there in Chicago, right? I think the country itself is one step away from a police state anyway. General Tommy Franks publicly stated that in the event of another terrorist attack, the military was just going to shut the Constitution down. So that's where we are today, and I think it just indicates that, you know, as citizens, we all have to exercise our First Amendment rights, freedom of speech, freedom of association, civil resistance, like Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Chicago, and elsewhere, and do the best we can to fight back and, you know, in a nonviolent manner against this developing police state and military dictatorship. Look, if they're going after me and putting me on all their terrorist watch lists, you can imagine what they're doing to everyone else.
They must find an informed mind terribly frightening, much like a terrorist. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. That's Dr. Professor Francis Boyle of the University of Illinois College of Law. He's the author of Tackling America's Toughest Questions. And in the minute or two remaining, Dr. Boyle, I leave the final word to you, along with my question. What did you find in Henry Kissinger's desk?
Well, when I moved in there, the janitor, Bud, who was a decent guy, informed me that I was moving into Kissinger's old office and that his file cabinets were there. And also that an award-winning New York Times reporter was attempting to get access to the office in order to rifle Kissinger's files. Well, I detested everything that Kissinger stood for, but I certainly did not approve of some reporter getting in there and stealing his files to get an expose. So I did make a cursory examination of the file cabinet. They were, in fact, Kissinger's files. And I did alert the office administrator for the Center for International Affairs, Sally Cox, Archie Cox's daughter.
Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor, right?
Archie's daughter, of the problem. She called up Kissinger in Washington. At that time, he was at the White House. And they sent a moving van in and took all the files away. So there you go.
Man of honor.
But I have to run to class.
How can people follow your work?
Tackling America's Toughest Questions. And then, you know, you can do a Google search under my name. And then I've got about 15 books at Amazon.com.
Well, thank you, Professor Francis Boyle. Good luck in your class today, and thank you for teaching us.
Jurisprudence.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow, Dr. Francis Boyle. Quite a revelation today. And that concludes today's edition. We'll be back tomorrow with more subterfuge and shadows of government operations and popular aspirations. I'd like to thank Michael G. Haskins for engineering today and Thiago Brozo for producing. And we also welcome and appreciate your advice, tips, comments, questions, and suggestions. Please send us an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.